Hi, everybody, and welcome to Context Countdown. I'm Andrew Kurupko, and I'll be going over 5 recent news stories that need to be placed in context. Some of them are misleading, while others are spot on, but either way, there's a context behind them, and I'm here to tell you what's really going on. Let's take a look at our top 5 countdown for the week. At number 5, we have Russia's fake news bill. This proposed piece of legislation will be discussed on the 14th of January and seeks to impose administrative fines of $450 to $750 for individuals and $6,000 to $15,000 for legal entities that share what is described as untruthful socially significant information disguised as authentic reports, which poses a threat to people's lives and health and is fraught with mass violations of public order and security, disruption in the operation of crucial life support facilities, transport, and social infrastructures, or other grave consequences. End quote. This vague catch-all description is necessary in order to encompass the many consequences that fake news, which the state wants to officially define in this context as untruthful socially significant information disguised as authentic reports, can have. Critics will predictably allege that it can be abused for so-called censorship purposes, and the Western mainstream media will probably blow this bill all out of proportion, but it's actually a prudent piece of legislation because it could counteract the strategic weaponization of fake news by state and non-state entities that either collaborate with individuals and legal entities or con them into sharing untruthful, socially significant information disguised as authentic reports that could pose real threats to people and society. As a perfect example of this, it's one thing to allege that an industrial accident or school shooting was an act of terrorism, and another to disguise one's personal views as authentic reports. The average individual might not be able to differentiate between the various information products that they're exposed to, which includes actual news, op-eds, analyses, conspiracy theories, and fake news to name but the most prominent, and could therefore panic if an unverifiable opinion about a major event, or in other words, what could be classified as untruthful, socially significant information, was passed off as officially confirmed information. Granted, there might be a fine line between how facts and opinions are presented, and it'll have to be worked out how the information purveyor can ensure that their audience has no ambiguity about which of the two is being shared, but the intention of the law itself is clear. What remains to be seen, however, is how it will be enforced in the realm of social media, especially on US-based platforms that are accessible in Russia. The question arises of whether Facebook, for instance, will be fined if a European user organization shares fake news about a socially significant event in Russia with the European audience, or only if they do it with the Russian one and in the Russian language. It's also unclear how Russia will be alerted to this happening, and whether Facebook will abide by the state's request to take down violating posts. Whatever ends up happening, though, it's clear that Russia's pioneering the way for all other states to follow in fighting fake news. The next one up is WikiLeaks asking media organizations not to say 140 things about Julian Assange. Reuters reported that the whistleblowing group sent an email discouraging others from spreading what it described as defamatory and false information about its founder, such as the dangerous claims that he's a Russian agent, and even gossipy ones that he supposedly has poor personal hygiene. WikiLeaks interestingly wrote that the email was confidential legal information, not for publication, though that apparently didn't deter news about it from hitting the mainstream. Nevertheless, the intended secretiveness behind it could give the group's enemies a superficial reason to allege that this is nothing more than a censorship list by an organization that hypocritically purports to be transparent. The hyper-liberalism that spread throughout the Western mainstream media and the run-up to Trump's election and its aftermath has created a freewheeling environment where it's apparently acceptable to publish anything about anyone so long as the claims advance the outlet's intended agenda, which is the opposite of how responsible media are traditionally supposed to behave. Faced with a non-stop onslaught of fake news about its founder, it makes sense why WikiLeaks felt it necessary to remind others of the journalistic standards that they're supposed to abide by, as well as give them a plethora of examples of what's therefore unacceptable to publish about Assange. Instead of being a censorship list, WikiLeaks' email is more like an ethical guideline for responsible journalists to keep in mind when covering its founder, seeing as how he'll probably be more in the news later this year as Ecuador reportedly moves closer to reaching an agreement with the US for his removal from its UK embassy. It's probably with that possible development in mind why WikiLeaks was moved to compile such an extensive list of false claims about Assange and advise the media not to include them in their coverage of him when they apparently hadn't thought to do that before. Should that be the case, then it could hint that the organization knows more about its potential fate than they're letting on, and fears that he'll soon again become the subject of intense media scrutiny if the worst-case scenario unfolds, where he's kicked out of his diplomatic safe haven and sent to the US for trial. In any event, and whether or not that transpires, all individuals, legal entities, and states could learn a lot from WikiLeaks' example by compiling a list of the fake news that was spread about them and discouraging the media from including them in their reports. They probably won't succeed in having that happen though, so it's best to make the public aware of what's fake news, debunk it all point by point, and then let them know that the media was also informed of this as well. The impression of seeing that so-called reputable outlets might still share fake news after knowing that they also received the same point by point debunking of it that others did could go a lot further than anything else in getting the public to realize the con game is being pulled on them and start questioning whether journalistic standards even still exist. Third on our countdown is the cancellation of the unofficial peace talks between the US and the Taliban. Before this happened, America rightly felt like it was losing control over the incipient peace process in Afghanistan after Russia adopted the long-standing Pakistani position a few years ago that the only realistic solution to the war is to talk with the Taliban as a legitimate political party to the conflict, following which the group was hosted in the Russian capital late last year during a dramatic event that symbolically heralded a new chapter in the South Asian saga. U.S. Special Envoy Zalmay Khalilzad shortly thereafter set out for a whirlwind tour of the larger region and declared his country's intent to restart the peace process that it had hitherto suppressed and inadvertently isolated itself from. Regrettably, the differences between the U.S. and the Taliban are apparently still too acute, which is why the group just announced that it canceled the planned talks that were supposed to have been held in Qatar earlier this week. The Taliban wants the U.S. to completely withdraw from Afghanistan as part of a peace deal and refuses to recognize the legitimacy of the Kabul government. While the U.S. is unlikely to leave the country without at least replacing its troops with mercenaries, and seems intent on having the group become part of a so-called transitional government. The timing of the talks and their abrupt cancellation take on an urgent importance because of the upcoming national elections later this year. Trump would have scored domestic political points if his government cut a deal with the Taliban to ensure that the vote goes off without a hitch, even if the U.S. had to concede a bit by recognizing the group as a legitimate political party. From the Taliban's perspective, it can be argued that temporarily conceding to run in Kabul-organized national elections, or at least not obstruct them, might have been worth it if the U.S. proved its goodwill either right beforehand or shortly afterwards by drastically reducing its troop presence in the country. At the same time, however, so-called hawks on both sides might have been unhappy with this prospective deal and sought to undermine it. Trump didn't really lose much by this happening because he can just continue portraying himself as a victim of unlucky circumstances and conspiracies, while Afghanistan will probably return back to the status quo of fratricidal violence. The Taliban, however, might bifurcate into so-called moderate and hardliner factions, with Pakistan potentially being blamed if some members defect to Daesh as a result, thus explaining why Islamabad sincerely did all that it could to keep the talks alive. Having said all of that, the public obviously isn't privy to all the ins and outs of what happened and why, meaning that it's still too early to rule out the resumption of peace talks sometime in the near future. Our runner-up is Pope Francis's crusade against nationalism. The Catholic pontiff was giving his yearly talk to the Vatican's diplomats earlier this week when he went off on a tangent talking about nationalism and its various ills when discussing the broader topic of multilateralism and international relations. Francis reminded his audience that this year marks the centenary of the League of Nations and warned them about how the present day supposedly carries with it the same resurgence of nationalist tendencies which ultimately doomed that promising organization, obviously alluding to the rise of fascism that eventually led to World War II. To his credit, however, he did acknowledge that some of this is a consequence of the reaction in some parts of the world to a globalization that has in some respects developed in too rapid and disorderly a manner, end quote. Even so, he lashed out against what he described as the search for a quick partisan consensus that some in the international media interpreted as a jab against Trump. It's no secret that Francis hates nationalism, because he probably blames it for the crimes that were carried out by the right-wing government of his native Argentina during parts of the old Cold War. But it's ironic that he himself is functioning as a partisan activist of sorts by fighting against it, and doing so under the cover of God, which is controversial for some Christians and others. Francis's solution to today's populist challenges is what he called polyhedric globalization, which he conceptualizes as a positive interplay between the identity of individual peoples and countries and globalization itself, in accordance with the principle that the whole is greater than the part, end quote. It's understandable why a religious figure would promote what he believes to be the common good, and he even went on to emphasize this overall idea when elaborating on the four characteristics, responsibilities, and purposes of multilateral diplomacy that St. Paul VI told the UN during the first time that a pope ever addressed that globalist body. He reminded them of the primacy of justice and law, defense of the most vulnerable, which Francis said also includes migrants, being a bridge between people and builders of peace, and rethinking common destiny. Altogether, however, the larger point of partisan contention remains, and it's that Francis is clearly using his religious pulpit to fearmonger about nationalism, establishing himself as a crusader against it in a similar way to how his predecessor, John Paul II, fought against communism. At our top spot, we've got Bolton's tour of the Mideast, which aims to influence the future of Syria. Trump's national security advisor is visiting the GCC+, the Gulf monarchies plus their Jordanian and Egyptian allies, Israel, and Turkey, in an attempt to explain to them the grand strategy that the president has in mind by withdrawing American forces from Syria. There are plenty of moving pieces, and the situation remains fluid, but it's still possible to ascertain an idea of what the U.S. is trying to achieve there as a result of Bolton's whirlwind diplomacy in the region, whether or not it ultimately unfolds as expected. Bearing in mind the current dynamics of the conflict around Idlib in the northeast, especially regarding the contentious issue of the Syrian Kurds, here's the master plan that Bolton is trying to advance through his latest Mideast tour. The YPG Kurdish militia, which Turkey regards as a terrorist group, has requested the assistance of the Syrian Arab Army in Manbij in order to deter Ankara's threatened intervention there, and it seems like they're in promising talks with one another over reaching a larger deal. One hint of what this might entail came from Syrian Democratic Forces commander Redur Halil, who said that reaching a solution between the autonomous administration and the Syrian government is inevitable, which interestingly dovetails with the proposal first officially put forth in the Russian written draft constitution for Syria that was unveiled almost exactly 2 years ago in reaction to the Kurds' self-declared federalization in spring 2016. A further convergence of interest comes from the U.S. clarifying that it won't withdraw from Syria unless Turkey ensures the security of the local Kurds there, which was followed up by President Erdogan announcing his support of local self-government in the region so long as PKK-linked groups like the YPG aren't represented there. Slowly but surely, everything seems to be coming together to the point where a realistic scenario might be that the Syrian Arab Army and YPG reach an autonomy deal to allow Damascus to regain control over the country's international borders in the northeast in exchange for giving the Kurds self-rule over the region, the details of which would be decided throughout the course of the forthcoming constitutional reform process mandated by UNSC Resolution 2254. It should go without saying that any progress on this front could also have a so-called demonstration effect in encouraging a similar decentralization process in Idlib, which might result in it becoming more of an internationally recognized part of Turkey's unofficial sphere of influence in Syria if it's successful. Having said that, the entrenchment of Turkish influence in Idlib and its possible expansion into the northeast will probably be countered by the GCC countries that Syria is currently reconciling with, though in exchange for Damascus requesting Iran's dignified but phased withdrawal from the country sometime later this year. That eventuality would nullify the reason for Israel to continue striking Syria and could even lead to a détente of sorts between the two historical adversaries. While there's no guarantee that events will unfold according to this master plan, it nevertheless appears to be the most logical endgame in sight given what's publicly known about all parties' positions at this time, though it could always be offset by one of them, if they decide to play the spoiler. All right, folks, there you have it. This wraps up this week's edition of Context Countdown. And as I always do, I want to warmly thank each and every one of you for tuning into my program. Hope you all have a nice rest of the week and tune in again next week. Thank you. Bye.